All right, so get ready, because today we're diving into one of the most incredible stories of resistance. And really, I mean, this is one of the biggest ones out there, you know. India's journey to independence. We're looking specifically between 1920 and 1947.
Yeah, it's a huge period.
And we've got a whole stack of sources here. Scholarly histories, personal accounts, like you name it, we've got it. And our mission is to uncover how these mass movements, and really it was fueled by this incredible strategic nonviolence and just the sheer willpower of millions of people. It brought down the British Raj. It's amazing.
It's a fascinating period because it really showcases the power of collective action. But to really understand how these mass movements emerge, we kind of have to rewind a bit. You know, go back to the 18th century. This is when the East India Company started to, like, transform from this trading entity into a, like, full-blown governing power.
Wait, hold on. So a company was ruling a country? That's kind of wild. That's like, I don't know, Amazon taking over the U.S. government or something.
Right. Yeah, it sounds crazy, but that's essentially what happened. And figures like Warren Hastings and Lord Cornwallis, they were, like, super instrumental in laying this whole foundation for what we know as the British Raj. They didn't just, like, you know, conquer territories. They established these whole administrative systems, legal frameworks, economic policies, the whole nine yards.
So they were basically building, like, a whole new government from scratch.
Exactly. And what's really fascinating is that they didn't just, like, completely erase all the existing systems. They kind of incorporated elements of Mughal practices, like they would acknowledge the Mughal emperor in Delhi. They even used his image on their coins.
Oh, wow.
It was a pretty clever way of, like, maintaining the semblance of continuity while they were asserting their authority at the same time.
Yeah, it sounds like they were walking this real delicate tightrope there.
Yeah.
But how did the Indian people react to all this? I mean, surely they weren't just going to, like, sit back and watch their country be transformed like that.
Of course not. Resistance started early on, even during the Battle of Plassey in 1757. You see, the act of imposing colonial rule really just planted the seeds for its eventual demise. It created this, like, inherent tension, this desire for self-determination that kind of simmered beneath the surface for decades.
So it's like that saying, for every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction.
Yeah.
But it wasn't just like one single reaction, right? You mentioned that there were diverse forms of resistance.
Absolutely. It wasn't a monolithic movement at all. You had armed rebellions, intellectual movements, challenging colonial ideologies, and of course, those nonviolent protests that would eventually come to define India's struggle for freedom. And one of the key players in this whole story is the Indian National Congress, or the INC. It was formed in 1885.
The INC.
Yeah.
Right. They started out like as a pretty moderate group, didn't they? Like asking for reforms within the existing system.
Yeah.
But then things kind of took this dramatic turn.
Exactly. By the early 20th century, there was this growing frustration with the colonial policies and this rising sense of national identity. The INC transformed into this powerful force demanding complete independence. And that's when we really start to see the emergence of figures like Mahatma Gandhi.
Okay. Yeah, you can't talk about India's independence without talking about Gandhi. I mean, he's almost like a mythical figure, right? The champion of nonviolent resistance.
He truly was a revolutionary figure. Gandhi's philosophy, Satyagraha, which means truth force, it emphasized nonviolent resistance as this way to fight oppression. And it's so fascinating because it wasn't just a political strategy. It was this deeply spiritual and ethical approach that was rooted in ancient Indian traditions.
So it wasn't just about achieving independence. It was also about doing it in a morally just way. Like Gandhi was taking the high road even when he was facing this like huge empire.
Exactly. Satyagraha wasn't about like defeating an opponent. It was about winning them over through moral persuasion. And it required so much courage and discipline because you're choosing to suffer at the hands of your oppressor rather than, you know, retaliate with violence.
Yeah, that's a powerful concept.
Yeah.
But how did it actually work in practice? I mean, how do you convince millions of people to adopt this philosophy and challenge this powerful empire without, you know, resorting to violence?
Well, that's where Gandhi's brilliance as a strategist really comes in. He had this incredible ability to, like, connect with the masses, articulate their grievances, and inspire them to take action. He used symbolic acts of defiance, like the famous Salt March of 1930, to really expose the injustices of British rule and mobilize people on this massive scale.
Okay, I've heard about the Salt March, but honestly, I don't really fully understand it. What was so significant about making salt?
Well, think about it. Salt is a basic necessity, right? It's essential for life. And the British government had imposed this salt tax, which meant Indians couldn't even produce their own salt without having to pay this, like, hefty price. And Gandhi saw this as a symbol of British oppression, and he decided to challenge it directly.
So he just, like, started making his own salt?
Well, not quite that simple. He led this massive march to the sea. Thousands of people joined him along the way, and they publicly made salt from seawater, directly defying British law.
Wow.
It was this brilliant move because it was peaceful and incredibly powerful act of resistance that captured the world's attention.
It's almost like a real-life David and Goliath story, except instead of a slingshot, Gandhi used a pinch of salt.
It's amazing how something so, like, seemingly simple could have such a profound impact.
Absolutely. The Salt March was this pivotal moment in India's struggle for independence. It galvanized the nation. It exposed the brutality of the British Raj to this international audience. And it solidified Gandhi's position as this leader of unparalleled moral authority. I can see why this period is considered so crucial, you know. It's like all these different threads, the historical context, the rising tide of nationalism, the emergence of Gandhi and Satyagraha, they're all coming together to create this, like, powerful movement for change.
Exactly. And this is just the beginning. The Salt March, it really marked the start of the civil disobedience movement, this nationwide campaign of non-cooperation that would just, like, shake the foundations of the British Raj.
Wow, I'm already hooked. This is way more interesting than I thought it would be.
Get ready, because things are about to get even more intense. We're going to dive into the strategies, the sacrifices, the incredible resilience of the Indian people as they took on the might of the British Empire.
All right, let's do it. Let's continue this deep dive and uncover the rest of this story.
So welcome back to our deep dive into India's fight for independence. We left off with Gandhi's Salt March and the beginning of the civil disobedience movement.
Yeah, it's mind-blowing how something as simple as making salt could spark a nationwide movement, you know. So tell me, how did the civil disobedience movement actually work? Like, what did it look like on the ground?
Well, imagine a nation, like, refusing to cooperate with its rulers. People from all walks of life, students, lawyers, merchants, even some government officials, they all joined the movement. They boycotted British goods, they refused to pay taxes, and some even resigned from their positions. It was huge.
It's like this giant, nope, we're not doing this anymore to the British Empire.
Yeah.
But how did they coordinate something this massive? I mean, were there, like, secret meetings and coded messages or what?
Oh, there were definitely networks of organizers and activists kind of working behind the scenes. But what's really remarkable is the level of, like, grassroots participation. I mean, news spread through word of mouth, pamphlets, even songs. Gandhi's message just resonated really deeply with people who were just, you know, tired of being treated like second-class citizens in their own country.
Yeah, it's incredible to think about the courage it must have taken for people to just stand up and say, enough is enough, knowing that they could face imprisonment or even worse.
Absolutely. Thousands of Indians were arrested during the civil disobedience movement. They faced beatings, imprisonment, you know, all sorts of hardships. But their sacrifices really kept the movement alive and put this, like, immense pressure on the British government.
So how did the British react to all of this? Did they just, like, give in and grant India independence?
Not immediately, no. They tried to suppress the movement through force, but the sheer scale of the resistance just made it incredibly difficult. And the economic impact of the boycotts, that was also significant, you know?
So Gandhi's strategy of nonviolent resistance, it was actually working.
It was proving to be incredibly effective. It forced the British to the negotiating table. They realized that holding on to India against the will of its people was becoming, you know, increasingly unsustainable. And it wasn't just happening within India either. The world was watching. And those images of peaceful protesters being, you know, beaten and jailed by British authorities, that really turned global public opinion against the empire.
Yeah, that makes sense. It's hard to justify, like, violence against people who are simply demanding their basic rights and who are committed to nonviolent resistance, right? So what happened next? Did the British just, like, pack up and leave?
Not quite. It was a long and complex process, lots of twists and turns. The British government, they offered some concessions, but, you know, they fell short of granting full independence. And then, you know, World War II broke out.
Oh, wow. I bet that threw a wrench in the works.
It really did. India was drawn into the war effort, and that demand for independence was, like, temporarily put on hold. But the war also had this really profound impact on the dynamics of the whole struggle.
How so?
Well, for one thing, it really exposed the hypocrisy of the British Empire. You know, here they were fighting this war against fascism and tyranny, yet they were denying these, like, basic freedoms to millions of Indians.
Yeah. That's a pretty tough argument to counter. It's like, hey, you're fighting for freedom over there, but what about freedom over here?
Exactly. And the war also weakened the British Empire, economically and militarily. And they realized that holding on to these vast colonies, including India, was going to be like increasingly difficult.
So the war kind of inadvertently created this window of opportunity for India's independence movement.
Exactly. And Gandhi, he sensed this shift and he launched the Quit India movement in 1942. And this time the demand was clear and unequivocal. It was like, British, leave India now.
That's a pretty bold move considering there was this global war raging on. What was the response like?
Well, the Quit India movement was met with some, brutal repression.
Fine.
Gandhi and other leaders, they were arrested, and there were these widespread protests and strikes across the country. But the movement, it was unstoppable. The British government, they realized that their time in India was coming to an end.
So the Quit India movement was basically the final push, the thing that really sealed the deal for India's independence.
It was a culmination of decades of struggle, sacrifice, and strategic nonviolent resistance. The Quit India movement showed the world that the Indian people were united in their demand for freedom and that the British could no longer hold on to their colonial grip.
This is such a powerful story. It's amazing how the Indian people, through just sheer determination and commitment to nonviolence, managed to dismantle an empire.
It's really a testament to the power of collective action and the human spirit's ability to overcome even the most like daunting challenges. But the story doesn't end there.
Yeah, I have a feeling there's more to this than just a simple happily ever after ending.
Unfortunately, you're right. The road to independence wasn't without its, tragic turns. And the partition of India and Pakistan, while it marked the end of colonial rule, it also unleashed just unimaginable violence and displacement.
Oh man, that's heartbreaking. So even in victory, there was like immense suffering. It's a reminder that history is rarely simple, or
Yeah,
straightforward.
exactly. And as we move into the final part of our deep dive, we'll explore the legacy of British rule in India, the good, the bad, and the complex.
All right, I'm ready to unpack this final chapter. Let's dive in and see what lessons we can learn from this, pivotal moment in history. Okay, so we've journeyed through India's fight for independence. We've seen the strategic brilliance, the sacrifices, just the sheer willpower of millions of people. But as we stand on the cusp of freedom, 1947, this crucial question kind of lingers. What kind of India emerged from the shadow of the British Raj?
It's a question that historians and Indians themselves are still grappling with. You see, colonial rule, it wasn't just a political or economic kind of phenomenon. It was a cultural force that really left an indelible mark on like every aspect of Indian society.
So it's like that saying, you can't unscramble an egg. Even after independence, the effects of British rule were still deeply ingrained in India's DNA. But let's try to unpack this a little bit. What were some of the most like significant legacies of the Raj?
Well, let's start with the political landscape. The British, they introduced parliamentary democracy, which is, a system of governance that India adopted. But they also created this like highly centralized bureaucratic structure that was often criticized for being out of touch with the needs of the people.
So it was democracy, but with a very British flavor. Like they handed over the keys to the car, but forgot to mention it was right-hand drive.
Yeah.
Did they even like try to prepare India for self-rule?
There were efforts, but they were often like half-hearted and riddled with contradictions. Take the Indian Civil Service, for example. This
Yeah.
was this elite bureaucratic body that was like modeled after the British system, and it played this crucial role in administering India. While it did produce some, brilliant administrators, it was often seen as this distant hierarchical structure that didn't fully like grasp the complexities of Indian society.
Yeah, it sounds like a recipe for tension, this clash between democratic ideals and bureaucratic control. And I imagine things got even more like complicated when you factor in the economic legacies of the Raj.
Absolutely. We talked earlier about the exploitative nature of British economic policies, how they just like drained India's wealth and stifled its industrial growth. But they also left behind this like mixed bag of infrastructure, railways, irrigation systems, ports, things like that. And they were like primarily built to serve British interests, but they ended up shaping the economic landscape of independent India.
It's like that old saying, every cloud has a silver lining.
Yeah.
But in this case, the silver lining was probably mined from India's own resources, right?
Right. And it's important to remember that these economic policies, they had this like long-lasting impact.
Yeah.
You know, they created disparities, they distorted regional economies, and they left independent India with this like daunting task of having to build a more equitable and sustainable economic system.
Okay, so we've got political structures and economic systems all shaped by colonial rule. But what about the social fabric of India? How did British influence play out in the lives of ordinary people?
Well, one of the most profound and lasting impacts was in the realm of education. The British, they introduced this Western-style education, which, you know, it opened up new opportunities for some Indians, but it also created this divide between the Western-educated elite and the vast majority of the population.
So it was like the double-edged sword, you know. Access to knowledge on the one hand, but cultural alienation on the other. Did it have any like lasting impact on Indian society?
Oh, it's still playing out today. English remains a language of power and privilege in India, even as there's this growing movement to like reclaim and revitalize indigenous languages. It's this constant tug of war between like embracing the globalized world and preserving this cultural identity.
It sounds like a microcosm of India's post-independence journey. You
Yeah.
know, navigating this complex web of inherited system trying to forge its own path while it's like grappling with the ghosts of its colonial past.
Exactly. And it's not just about institutions or languages, you know. British influence, it permeated even like the smallest details of everyday life,
Okay.
you know, from clothing styles to culinary habits, legal systems, social norms, all sorts of stuff. It's this like tapestry that's woven with threads of both, you know, progress and oppression, innovation, exploitation.
It's fascinating and kind of overwhelming to think about the sheer scale and depth of this influence, you know. But as we wrap up this deep dive, I'm curious, what's the takeaway for our listener? What can we learn from India's experience?
I think the biggest lesson is that freedom is a journey, not a destination. Even after throwing off the shackles of colonial rule, the fight for true liberation, you know, economic, social, cultural, it continues.
Yeah, it's a reminder that history doesn't end with like a neat little bow tied on top. It's an ongoing process, you know, a conversation between the past, the present, and the future.
Exactly. And as we look at India today, you know, this vibrant, diverse democracy navigating the complexities of the 21st century, we can see the echoes of its colonial past in both its triumphs and its challenges.
It's a powerful reminder that understanding history, it isn't just about memorizing dates and names.
Yeah.
It's about connecting with the human story, grappling with the complexities, and drawing lessons that can inform our understanding of the world, you know, the world today.
And on that note, this has been the Deep Dive.